GM pays over $1 billion for self-driving car technology, Snapchat's secret VR project, and the App Store is full of garbage. All that and a lot more coming up on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1468, recorded Friday, March 11th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT.
And by the Ring video doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your home. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/TNT.
And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting software that's giving thousands of freelancers and small businesses the tools to save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/TNT. Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about all the tech news with people who are passionate about technology. I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. Joining us here at the table, not virtually, but in the room.
I'm here.
David Spark. How's it going, David?
It's going great. Thank you for having me. Love being here in the Brick House.
Yeah, it's always good to get you in here. So tell people a little bit about kind of what you do. I know your site is sparkmediasolutions.com. What do you do?
We are brand journalists. We are essentially big media companies, mostly big B2B tech companies. They hire us. We produce a lot of media. We shoot fun videos often at trade shows and conferences. We were just at the RSA conference shooting some fun videos. If you go to sparkminute.com, you can see a silly video where, honest to God, I walked the floor at RSA and blatantly asked people, how do I break into your network?
And some people actually were willing to tell you piece by piece how you break into their network, which is the first rule of security. Don't do that.
Here's the tip, and I learned, and a friend of mine pointed this out. Watch the video, and you'll find out that pretty much 1 in 5 people will let you in their network if you buy them dinner.
Yep.
Oh, all right. Well. Dinner. That's good to
That's
know.
All it takes.
Good. Well, after the show, what are you doing? Have dinner?
You're trying to get into his network? Is that what's going on here?
Oh. All right. Maybe
there's not much interesting to find there, except literally the thousands of kid pictures, if you really want to see them. And I'll just show it to you until you get bored of them.
Right. Which we discussed before is after the fifth picture, right? If it's not your kids. All right. Let's get started with the news. A startup that began with dreams of you strapping a giant $10,000 sensor-filled bar to the top of your car in order to make it self-driving has just been purchased by GM for reportedly over $1 billion. That's according to Recode. Cruise Automation started at Y Combinator and has now pivoted from creating aftermarket kits to turn cars autonomous to creating self-driving car software that GM will integrate into its cars. See, we were talking before, you asked about, you know, self-driving cars. What does our audience feel about self-driving cars? I think we're all cautiously optimistic. I want them right now. I know there are a lot of people that like driving. I'm not one of them. How do you feel about self-driving cars?
You know, I'm definitely from the world that I haven't gotten that eager to use it. But I know that Becky Worley was on the show. I think she'd done one. And she was oddly comfortable being in a self-driving car, but she was also in this ludicrously closed course and going like a mile and a half an hour. So she could literally have rolled out of the car should something have gone wrong. I just think in general that the automotive industry is changing, and the old days of just making new cars and getting people to buy new cars every 3 years is over, and they need to find new solutions. And this sort of sharing economy of cars through like Lyft and Uber is definitely a new trend, and they're going to have to, the car manufacturer is going to have to learn a way to generate revenue in this new new style of economy.
I feel like at one point, you know, years ago, there was the whole electric car movement, and then the car companies, the major car companies, were kind of afraid of that, and so they squashed it, and then it came back, you know, almost out of necessity, and they were willing to jump on board. Maybe surprised is the wrong word, but I'm surprised that some of the car companies may have learned their lesson in that regard. Because when it comes to autonomous cars, autonomous vehicles, I almost like my gut instinct would be that they would resist it because it goes against what they're comfortable with after however many, you know, like right around 100 years of doing business, some of these companies, that they would resist this sort of technological advancement. But GM, I mean, paying $1 billion, I guess 6 weeks ago, they were just talking to them about strategic investment, and then quickly it just kind of reportedly turned into a $1 billion acquisition.
Yeah, but the whole issue is, you know, you can resist things until you actually look at your financial statement and realize just being adamant ain't cutting it anymore.
Yeah,
you know,
fair enough.
Have to change, and I think a lot of, you know, they're not just the only industry. So many industries. I mean, look at the hotel industry, Airbnb, and the taxi industry. They're the ones, you know, the most damaged. So many industries just have to adapt and change. They got no choice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think GM, it's sort of this three-part plan. They first had invested in Lyft. So they had made a $500 million investment in Lyft. Then they launched their car sharing company, Maven. So, and then now they have the technology to build into the car. So I think, you know, because that seems to be where we're going. It's car sharing. Then, you know, it's the Lyft Uber kind of thing. And then, because that's where the first self-driving cars are going to probably be, like a Lyft Uber situation. We're not all going to have our own self-driving cars.
But, you know, with all this said, is there's not just the self-driving cars, the electric cars, the shared economy. And while the only one that's really kind of taking off is the sort of the Uber and the Lyft model and sort of the new way we're seeing car culture. But there's going to be other ways. And there were attempts, you know, I was researching again. Do you remember Shai Agassi had started this company, Better Place, which burned through $850 million in this attempt to create this sort of electric car network where they were just sharing batteries? That's all it was. Mm-hmm. It sounded awesome at the time. And that's the thing, is that people get very excited about these ideas, but there's so much sort of behind making it physically possible that, you know, we don't know if these things can take off or not. And honestly, I don't know how the Better Place completely collapsed as it did, but he was on fire when he first introduced it.
Yeah, I mean, as far as autonomous vehicles are concerned, I feel kind of the same way about VR. I hate to put VR and autonomous vehicles in the same category, but they're new technologies that in one alternate universe, it could be the kind of thing where that's a little too experimental and it's going to fail. You know, even though it's cool, it's going to fail, kind of like what you're talking about with that company. But in the current reality of where we are, there's just enough big names that are as excited about it as the other people are that you really kind of expect that at some point it's going to actually turn into something. It's not just going to evaporate, you know, become nothing.
Well, I will throw it, you know, I was just thinking about this before also, is 3D TV.
Yeah.
That never took off.
That's a really good counterpoint. I will give you that for sure. Although it's still kind of there. It's just no one cares.
Is there any 3D programming or manufacturers still selling those anymore?
Well, I mean, you can get 3D Blu-rays and all that kind of stuff.
Can you count more than two?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I'm not getting them, that's for sure. All right, so yes, we're talking about Apple FBI again, but don't worry, there's some new stuff here.
You've brought this up on the show before.
It's been a little bit here and there. But, you know,
and I'm sure nobody has an opinion about it.
No, not at all. I'm sure we won't see the chat room explode here in a few seconds. The Department of Justice seems to be ramping things up in its fight with Apple in the San Bernardino case. The filing we spoke about yesterday contained a footnote, actually, that shows how much the DOJ is tightening its efforts. All along, Apple has claimed that being forced to write the code that would route access around its security measures would be, quote, unduly burdensome. That's basically a way out, thanks to the All Writs Act. Well, the Department of Justice said in its footnote that it could not modify the software itself without access to, what do you think, the source code, so iOS source code. So apparently, well, notably, the request has precedent. The secure email service called LavaBit, remember this from a couple of years ago, they refused to hand over encryption keys to the FBI's request, and they were sanctioned for contempt of court as a result. So I just kind of find it fascinating, this kind of chess game that's happening right now, where it's like, well, you don't want to cooperate, fine, then we want all your code. Just give us all of your code then. You don't want to create the code for us? Give us everything.
Well, I thought that, you know, normally in a negotiation, you start high and come down low. But now they started down low and went up high.
Apparently. Apparently.
Yeah, it's just all threats. And the Lavabit case is interesting. That was the Snowden case. And Lavabit shut down. I mean, they had to shut down. That's not going to happen with Apple. I mean, they're not going to shut down. So what is going to happen? That's what's fascinating to me. I don't know. I mean, yeah, basically they're saying like, yeah, you didn't want to hand over a little bit, then hand it over a lot. Like,
then
you
check
know,
this out.
It seems kind of
And I, as I understand, this is going to be the last time you're going to talk about this case at this point, right?
Oh, at all.
It's never, ever going to be a story again.
Let's just say that some days we have no choice. Look, we've got a show to fill and there's only so much news. This was one of them.
Well,
so,
I think this is still news. No. It's still
huge
big
news.
And yeah, I mean, I think we wouldn't talk about it unless there were new things, new and interesting things that people need to be paying attention to. I mean, there were so many hidden things in that filing. One thing that I thought was interesting is this is a quote. The county had installed a remote management program on the phone, but hadn't fully implemented it with remote management control. That was a part of the story that I hadn't heard before. So what they're saying is that, like, it's partly the county's fault. Like, this was not his personal phone. This was the county's. It was his business phone, and they could. That's basically what the filing is saying. I don't know if this is true or really has any bearing to the case, but it's a piece of it that I hadn't heard before. Like, the county kind of failed. Like, as an employer, they should have been able to have access to that information. And again, it leads to, it's not Apple's fault. It's not Apple's responsibility. The county has some responsibility in this as well.
Some. I mean, in their view. Now, in related news, President Barack Obama spoke at a keynote at the South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas earlier today, had some comments directly related to the case. He stressed that the tech industry should be working with the government instead of leaving it in the hands of Congress, saying that phones shouldn't be, quote, black boxes that the government can't have access to. He said that an absolutist view on encryption fetishizes phones above everything else. So definitely taking a strong stance here, which I think we kind of expected.
I'll repeat a quote from a member of ACLU that I had interviewed many, many years ago when I was in my days at Tech TV and ZDTV. He said, when we have situations like this where technology can just sort of obliterate any privacy, the absolute only thing we have to protect ourselves is laws. That's it. Mm-hmm. You don't have other technology to protect yourself. You've got laws to protect yourself. Sure. So, I mean, in some sense, we do. You know, we create security precautions. But so that's why you have groups like the ACLU and EFF. Just they're hammering every single time one of these issues comes up, because all we got to protect ourselves is laws here. And that's pretty scary, because, as we know, laws do get broken a few times. And sometimes they get broken and there's nothing we can do about it. And, like, the damage is already done after the case.
All right. Well, if you are one of the many people who use the Instacart app to summon a person to shop and deliver your groceries to your front door, you might consider tipping them more. The Wall Street Journal says that shoppers' pay has been cut by 63% from $4 per trip to $1.50 per trip. Instacart says that they're doing this to reduce variability and to help shoppers get more orders. Now, stories like this are interesting to me, but I never use services like that. You're in San Francisco. Do you use Instacart?
I have not, but my wife has used the Google Now, or Google, well, not, it's not Now. What is it called? The Google Bring Me Food Right This Second service. Whatever it's called.
Like the Amazon She's Now? Used
that. Google Express.
Google Express. Thank you. Yeah. I think actually my title's better, actually.
Yeah,
Google Now. I think that exists.
No, Google Now is the thing on the phone.
I have
no,
two
I know
kids.
That.
Bring me food right now this second.
Yeah,
that's what it should be called.
Yeah, that, even better. I like your title better. She's using that. And yeah, well, they, you know, the whole point of driving the prices down lower, and by the way, according to the story here, they're lowering their pay of the contractors while increasing the charge per service. So that doesn't really sit well with anybody, does it?
Yeah.
But no, it's 63%. Who here watching, listening, could take a 63% cut in their pay and still be at that job?
Yeah, I mean, some of the drivers were saying, you know, this was something that I did for extra, you know, for extra income on the side at $1.50 per trip. I just don't even think it's worth it anymore.
They're paying for the maintenance of their car, their insurance of the car, and the gasoline. Yeah. And so when the company says $15 to $20 an hour, which is not that high, you know the reality is going to be lower than that. And they have all their expenses on top of it. Usually when people are earning that kind of money, they're not also paying out of pocket for other stuff.
And that's with tip. That's with tip.
Yeah, including, yeah. So it's, but again, it's the company's estimate. It's like, you know, the miles per gallon rating you see on the car, whoever actually achieves that.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody does.
Yeah, fair enough. So, I mean, this is just kind of, unfortunately, just kind of par for the course with startups like this. Uber, Lyft, they both dropped their, increased their rates. So drivers, and basically what they end up telling the people that are doing the work for them, you know, in the case of Uber, Lyft, and now here is, well, you can make more money. Just drive more.
I know.
You know?
And sleep less.
I'm sorry.
Because that'll be good, you know, if you're sleeping less and you're driving. Why could that be bad?
Look, you have unlimited earning potential. You just have to drive 24 hours a day.
Yeah, and then we all saw Taxi Driver, if you remember what happened in that movie.
Yes.
Uber Driver. That should be the new
Oh, there
new
you
taxi
go.
Driver.
That'd be awesome.
Okay, so is there like a war brewing in the streets of San Francisco between the, you know, the people that are working these jobs and the people that are expecting?
I don't think it's exclusive to San Francisco by any stretch. This is a major issue I just see in any kind of contract job. So you look at Upwork, which is now the combination of Elance and Odesk, mm-hmm. and you look at the price people are paying to do jobs that for which you would get, you know, multiple fold greater salary if you worked in an office.
Right.
I mean, it's amazing how low. So one of the things I realized, and actually I saw this research from a study, I think a company called SoftChoice, is a huge percentage of people will take an enormous, enormous cut in pay for flexibility in their life. And that is huge. Now, mm-hmm. a lot of companies just offer flexibility, but some are very willing to reduce their pay to have that flexibility. Mm-hmm. And to be a full-time contractor where you have complete flexibility, you know, well, you know, I guess you're going to have that reduced pay whether you like it or not.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, and sometimes you can afford it and sometimes you can't. I know, like, women traditionally value that temporal flexibility over, you know,
right.
other. And that's part of why women get paid less. It's not just that everyone's sexist and women are just getting paid less. Part of it is that we choose to have more flexible jobs that pay less. So,
exactly.
You know, I mean, that is part of this story, too. I think this is part of the investor story, I think, in Silicon Valley and other mm-hmm. places, I guess, too. I mean, investors are not as bullish as they were before. They don't want to pay as much so that, you know, that's why Instacart has to start.
But here's the thing. What's to stop them from doing this? If they still have drivers who will still work at this low rate, why stop doing it? Like they're mm-hmm. looking for the bottom of the floor.
Yeah,
and I think they probably hit it.
You know, at yeah, $1.50 a trip. That's pretty darn low.
Yeah, I mean that's where we go into the, you know, the realm of economics. Yeah, it's true. Like who are we to say like that if someone wants to work for that, why not let them? Yeah, but
do you do damage though when you're searching for the bottom and then you reach it and you realize there's enough rebellion to the bottom that you might not recover?
Well, here's my philosophy also on paying and people who hire contractors and stuff. I always say that I hire someone, half the money I pay them is to do the job, and the additional half I pay them, so the, you know, 50% is to do the job, the other 50% is for me to trust them and I don't have to worry about them.
Right.
So if you're paying them at this incredibly low, low rate,
you get what you pay for.
Where's the trust?
Yes.
That's the big thing. You've got to trust the people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough. All right. So, David, you included a link earlier today from The Economist called The Future of Computing. And it tells of the future of something we've taken for granted for so long. I know I have. This has just been something I've heard about for so long that is just kind of part of how I think about technology, Moore's Law. So I guess before we kind of get into this, let's start there. Explain as best as you can what Moore's Law is.
Well, I think most of the people watching know what Moore's Law is. It's been around, I didn't realize, 50 years.
Yeah.
They claim that was
and it's been relevant. And
I didn't realize it had been around for 50 years. But the idea is the processing power doubles roughly every 2 years as, you know, smaller transistors are packed in. So this is why we get this ludicrous acceleration rate and smaller stuff. But we've plateaued. We're more or less plateauing at this point. And it's not a situation, and this is why I thought this article was so interesting and perfect for this audience, is it's not a situation that technology is slowing down. It's just the speed of technology is not based on processing power anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's other things. And and what they point out is it's software or the sort of the better algorithms in software. It's cloud computing, I think, predominantly. And it's also chips that are designed to do very specific tasks.
Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, there is a little bit that goes into kind of the the space, the limits of how tiny things can get well, right?
Space doesn't sort of increase, you know, I guess inversely, if you will.
Right.
Yeah, and Moore's Law didn't imagine all the things that we see now, like cell phones in our pockets or, you know, just the AlphaGo, the deep learning and, you know, that kind of thing that the machines would. I mean, where's the law there? When are they going to be smarter than us? Like that's the interesting thing that I want to hear, because it does feel like the more we talk about this, that it is, you know, deep learning, neural networks, that stuff is
One of the things they pointed out was this champion Go player had just been beaten by computer, and it wasn't based on raw computing power, which is the way I believe Deep Blue operated with playing chess. But it was, you know, based on these algorithms that it was operating under.
And learning from,
specifically. Yeah. Not specifically that it was cranking through, you know, more options than a human can physically handle.
It wasn't just flipping through a manual going, well, then the next obvious choice is.
Which is what I believe is the way, you know, Deep Blue operated, because it could just handle more processing power than a human could.
Right. So does this mean that Moore's Law is irrelevant at this point? Or
according to this article, they said that Moore's Law is essentially kind of coming to an end here. I mean, also, I mean, think about that. You guys, both of you have been in sort of computing and reporting about computing while. Do you remember when it was like a big deal that the next chip came out?
Yeah.
I couldn't tell you what chip we're on right now. I don't have a clue. But I remember you go from 286 to 386 to 486 to Pentium. And it became literally each one was... Because it just meant you could do completely different things that you couldn't do before. Mm-hmm. And now that's the lowest level computer can pretty much handle most things you need to do.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, we're carrying them around in our pocket. You know, we're carrying around what in our pockets would have amazed us 10 years ago. You know,
And even when you take a look at, you know, things that you would have once kind of siphoned off to, let's say, a high-powered desktop computer, we're doing a lot of, you know, this advanced photo manipulation and stuff on our devices, you know, more and more apps and things are being released that kind of bring those desktop functionalities into your pocket, and not just in kind of a low-rent sort of way. They're actually pretty impressive.
Well, one of the arguments is this machine you got here, is this just like kind of a dumb machine?
It's a Chrome OS.
So it's
a Chromebook Pixel. Yeah.
Okay. So this is one of the arguments they made, is that you don't need a powerful machine. You can have a net PC of some sort that all its processing power is more or less coming from the cloud.
Sure.
And that was kind of the big argument in the article.
Right. Interesting stuff.
So, yeah, someone in our chat room said Moore's Law isn't dead. It's just napping. I like that.
That's a good line.
We'll wake you up when we're ready for you, Moore.
All right. Well, what if you could puke Snapchat rainbows, but in virtual reality? You will find out. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, ZipRecruiter. If you listen carefully to every word we say on the show, and I hope that you do, you learned last night that Jason Howell has a soft spot in his heart for movie theaters because he used to work at one. I used to work in a bookstore.
David, I used to work at a movie theater, too.
You did?
I worked at a multiplex, and I used to sit in a room and pop 100 garbage bags of popcorn a day.
Is that what did you do at the movie theater?
I did everything.
From
concessions all the way up to management.
I did concessions as well, too.
I was a lifer.
Well, you probably got those jobs by filling out an application, walking in, saying, give me a job.
I accepted many applications.
I would say it also predated the internet. I'm that old.
So you walked in, you had the paper. We remember those paper applications. Uh-huh. It's not like that anymore. Now you need a place like ZipRecruiter, especially if you're trying to hire someone right this second. The best candidates like Jason Howell and David Spark are not just walking through your front door. They are out there on the internet, and you have to use brute force to find them. Sometimes it feels harder than cracking into an iPhone. As a business owner, your company is only as good as the people you hire. Posting jobs in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates, and short staffing leaves little time to post to dozens of job sites. Thanks to ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites with one single click and be instantly matched to candidates from over nearly 6 million resumes. Just post once, and within 24 hours, watch your candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter has been used by over 400,000 businesses, and you can try it now for free. Getting the right people for your company is so important. Scott is a happy ZipRecruiter client. He says the recruiting process used to be so painful. Before I'd post to several places, get a million resumes, but only a few responses from qualified candidates. It was torture. But with ZipRecruiter, we post once and get qualified candidates in one easy-to-review place. We've hired some of our best employees using ZipRecruiter. Today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today.
All right, so it used to be that social networks were just that, just social networks. But more and more with the advent of wearable technology and AR, VR technology, that sort of stuff, these companies are branching out into hardware. Sean Hollister, senior editor at CNET, joins us to talk a little bit about that. Welcome, Sean.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. So Snapchat is reportedly working on bringing some hardware experts into its fold and have been for a little while now. You had the scoop on this. What's this all about?
Well, what it's about is one day somebody I know told me that Snapchat was trying to hire them for an industrial designer position, which I thought was very interesting because Snapchat doesn't make hardware, right? Doesn't it a social app where you take pictures that disappear? But I did a little bit of digging and I found out that they have not one or two, but all kinds of people on staff now with background in consumer hardware. They've got industrial designers. They've got a marketing executive who helped popularize the Sphero rolling ball toy that became the BB-8 droid that was so hot this last holiday season, the Parrot AR drone before that. They've got folks from Logitech who worked on the Yui Boom Bluetooth speaker, somebody who worked on Nokia phones. All these people, why are they there?
Why indeed?
So, well, maybe that's a question for you. Why are they there? Do you have any idea?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, it sounds like if you connect the dots, you come up with this picture that they're working on some glasses, something maybe like Google Glass or something maybe like HoloLens. The first thing that happened, something that we found out actually last year, was that Snapchat purchased a company called Vergence Labs. They used to make a set of glasses you put on your face, and it just takes video of what you see. That was all it did. They wanted to sell that for a few hundred dollars. And they got snapped up by Snapchat all of a sudden for $15 million. Now, maybe that was just an acqui-hire. Maybe that was just something where they wanted these people or they wanted some patents. But no, the critical people who were involved in that are still at the company. And I've heard that they might be the people interviewing for these new designer roles. And so now you take a look at some of these other people they brought on board, some of these other hires. You find people who've had previous experience building tiny miniaturized circuit boards for smart glasses. You find people who design eyeglass frames for a living. You find people who recruited engineers who worked on the Microsoft HoloLens headset and the Microsoft Xbox before that. And you find a job posting at Snapchat for a role involving computer vision, this technology that allows computers to tell what they're seeing in front of them, to identify objects and people, that links that to whatever this consumer product is. So the other thing that they did recently was they hired a whole bunch of research engineers, a lot of them. I found at least 15 people specializing in computer vision and machine learning for a new research division. Folks thought maybe that was just about, let's identify people in pictures. That way you can pick out your friends or you can take a look at their face and put special lenses over, which is something Snapchat sells now. Now it looks like maybe those folks are part of the glasses project.
Hmm. How does the BB-8 Sphero fit in? I know you talked about things that would recognize things in front of it, but how do you think maybe they're going to make a Sphero that's the little Snapchat yellow ghost?
I don't think so. That's just their director of marketing, their new head of marketing. That was something that she helped popularize before she came to Snapchat. She helped work on that. She worked on popularizing the Parrot AR drone. The question is, why would you need someone like that? If you're just experimenting, if you're just doing research, that's somebody you bring on board when you have a piece of hardware that you want to be popular, that you want to be a hot item that people want to buy, that these teens who use Snapchat want to buy. So it'd be weird for her to be there otherwise, I think.
Yeah. Do you see, it seems like it's probably more of an augmented reality play here than anything, because you're talking about the glasses. Being that Snapchat is a more sort of alternative, younger skewing social network. How do you, and again, I know you don't know the answer, but maybe your projection, how do you see them possibly integrating Snapchat with the glasses?
I would imagine that there's the low hanging fruit here. The low hanging fruit here is simply making it really, really easy to take a snap. Right now, you pick up your phone, and once you get to the Snapchat, it's really easy. You tap the phone to take a picture, you hold it down to take a video. But if you had the glasses, you wouldn't need to turn on your phone and go to the Snapchat app before you take the picture. Snapchat is all about getting these real life moments, not a Kodak photo, not a Kodak photo where everybody's posed and they're all happy and wonderful. It's, you know, it's Justin Bieber in this moment of personal agony or something like that, where he's willing to share it with the world, but he's not willing for the world to see it forever. He wants it to be self-destructed, like Snapchat's other photos, after a short period of time, so people don't hang it over his head for the rest of his life. And now people can get those real life people, you know, candid shots of folks just by tapping a pair of glasses.
Actually, you know, the way you describe it, it sounds like maybe it'd be maybe kind of a continuous recording device, because, you know, we're all parents here at the desk, is that those moments that you want, where you pull up your phone and your camera and they go, they stopped doing it.
Right.
But if you were continuously recording, you could just, you know, rewind a few seconds and then boom, get that moment. So I kind of like the way you describe it there.
You can do that today. The Xbox and the PlayStation 4 have a feature right now. You're playing a game, you do some kind of incredible stunt, you send your motorcycle over the ramp and it's careening off the bridge and it smacks a helicopter on its way down. You're like, oh, that was really cool. I wasn't recording, sorry. And then you press the button. You press the button and you say, well, record that. Xbox, record that. You say it to your Kinect microphone if you got the Kinect attached to your Xbox. And it knows that it should record the previous thing, the thing that you were already doing. It can do that. So why not do that in a pair of glasses? The other thing it could do, if this involves computer vision, if this is like looking in front of it and identifying objects, what if it can automatically pick out your friends too? What if it can describe the scene in front of it? What if you take a snap and you don't have to caption it, and you don't have to tag anybody like you might do on Facebook? You just snap, it's up there on the internet immediately, already with the information that people need to know about it, already shared to the people who are involved. That's something you can do with computer vision.
I think what I find fascinating about this is the obvious correlation for me is, of course, Google Glass. Now, I have a pair of Google Glass. I went through the whole glass thing. I was a glass explorer, in air quotes. One of my favorite things, by the way.
You chose the positive term to describe the glass
user. Yes, I did. The thing that I loved glass for was absolutely the camera aspect. I was able to capture my youngest daughter, take her very first steps while wearing Google Glass. Oh. And I have that. In my perspective,
alone,
it was amazing.
That alone but, is worth it.
Totally. But the problem
was... Is that
was,
worth your $1,500?
Well, it wasn't my $1,500. Leo actually bought it, so I wouldn't have paid $1,500 for it. But I'm happy that he did, because I got that out of it. But what I'm fascinated about with this is that 2 years ago, the public was not ready for an on-your-face camera that's always showing. It was one of the main criticisms that people had about Google Glass. It, of course, did a lot of other things, but that was the one thing that people really zeroed in on. You're invading my privacy. And that Snapchat skews so much younger. I'm very curious to know if now is the time, 2 years later, for a new generation to actually accept it.
So interesting. So I'll quote Mo Rocca. You know, he used to be a correspondent for The Daily Show. They used to go out and do shoots, and whenever they had someone like 30 plus and they have an interview, they'd kind of explain, this is what we're going to do. We're going to set up a shoot. You know, we'll have the camera here. You're going to talk to me. You know, kind of explain the whole thing. Whenever they'd have a teenager on the camera, they go, yeah, I got it. Let's go.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing. Like, there's no confusion. So teens are so accepted to be on camera. Yeah. Quickly, though, about the funny story about people getting upset about Google Glass, and there was a famous story at the intersection of 16 and Mission of someone punching someone a Google Glass. Intersection in San Francisco has more cameras than any intersection, I think, in the entire city.
Yeah.
And the irony
is not on your face.
No, yeah. But the irony they got upset was like, because there used to be like an insane number of drug deals that would go down to that intersection. And so it's like,
what if
you're
it
being
didn't
recorded
have to do,
all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
What if it didn't even have to do with privacy? What if the fact that Snapchat destroys these photos and videos so quickly, what if that was the reason people would be okay with this? What if it was something where right now, okay, if I take a snap on my phone, even right now, I can technically save that by taking a screenshot on my phone of the thing I just snapped. But if I got a pair of glasses with no screen, what if I take this picture and I use my voice to tell the headset, the friends I want to send it to, and even I don't get the option to save a copy of that picture later. That way, no matter who I take a picture of, no matter what kind of scenario they're in, it's only shared with a few other people who I specify. It doesn't live forever. Maybe outsiders would be more accepting of that. I don't know.
Maybe, but that's a lot of education for outsiders.
Yeah, that is a lot of education.
I mean, if you sent it to my smartphone, I could take a screenshot of it, you know, and then I could save it. I mean, that's the thing about Snapchat, and that's that, yes, if you're sending it among friends and you don't have creepy friends, it is wonderful because, you know, especially for kids, you don't have to look great in every picture. You don't have to curate your life. But there's also, there's also the idea that anyone could save it. So you really, even with Snapchat, like that's what you need to tell people. You can't promise that
you
that's going
to
disappear. So I get what you're saying. And I think like if everyone has that attitude, and it maybe that will change. Maybe what we're talking about, the younger generation doesn't really care if they're being watched all the time.
They're so used to taking pictures of everything anyways. Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of ingrained in them, in their the way they use their phones nowadays. I mean, so.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Three old farts telling you how teenagers are being raised.
So. We do it every day. It's what we do here. Sean Hollister, it was great to finally get you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Sean.
Tell people where they can follow all your work online, where they can find you on Twitter, all that kind of stuff.
CNET.com. That's the place to go. And I'm on Twitter at Starfire2258. And there's a long story behind that. But I'm keeping it. I've got my internet geek pride and I'm sticking to it.
Awesome. Do it. Do it. I like it. Thanks again, Sean.
Thanks, Sean. All right, now's the time where we take an email from you, random TNT listener Silent Mike, had a use case for the Rando app we talked about a few weeks ago. The Rando app will randomly take a photo from your photo album and either post it on social media or send it to someone. You get to approve it, but it's just a random photo. And Silent Mike writes, I currently have 7,774 photos in my camera roll, and I don't see much prospect of ever printing them out. I have been texting my wife one of the pics every day so someone can enjoy them. Rando would be a great way to automate the process. Sometimes I spend 10 minutes at work trying to decide which photo to send her. I think Rando would come in handy. So I am glad that Silent Mike feels like he could send a random picture from his photo roll to his wife. I hope most people could do that. I think it's great. It's true. And it is just what we were talking about, that we as, you know, our generation, we're digital hoarders. Like we can keep all those photos on our phone or in our cloud. And so we do. And we what are we ever going to do with them?
No, this is a major issue, is sort of keeping up with all the content that you create. I think I might have told you this, but I started this project with my own kids where I shoot a video every single day of my kids, and I have this unbelievable archive of their lives since day one. I have yet to miss a day, and of 5 and 2, and it's kind of like incredible. But if I let it go more than a week, then it becomes a problem. Mm-hmm. So a maximum I let no more than like a week worth of videos that I have to go through and mm-hmm. figure out and post it. But yeah, this if you let the digital media of your life get ahead of you, it then becomes more of a burden than anything else.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like I've got all my photos uploading automatically to Google Photos. Right. And I mean, you know, and some of them are outdated, so they need to be sorted. And I mean, it's just, you know, I've got tens of thousands of photos up there now. Like I'm never going to sit down and find, you know, because I don't have the spare time to do many other things, let alone sit down and, archive and figure out.
Yeah, but thing if you have a few minutes of time, you look at your phone, you just start deleting the garbage on your phone.
I don't even do that.
No, it's,
I let the garbage pile up, apparently. I probably should do that, but I don't. Coming up, we're going to chat with Renee Ritchie about the future of indie app development. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode. That's the Ring Video Doorbell. Fantastic little device. I have it installed at our front door and we love it. And you know what happens when the doorbell rings? You know that it's something important, right? Somebody important's there. So a package is being delivered. Friends are coming over for dinner. It might be the sound of someone planning to rob you. It could be, wait, what? Over 95% of home break-ins happen during the day. Burglars almost always start by ringing your doorbell to see if someone's home before they rifle through all your stuff and take the things that they like. With the Ring Video Doorbell, you can see and talk to anyone that's standing at your front door from anywhere in the world that you happen to be using your smartphone. Ring's advanced motion detection alerts you even if someone does not ring the doorbell. You can set the sensitivity on that. With Ring Video Doorbell, you can talk to delivery people. You can keep an eye on the packages that they drop off. If someone tries to take that package, you'll get an instant alert and HD video of the entire thing. That can be stored in the cloud so you have it for later if you need be. It's like having a neighbor keeping an eye on your home 24/7. I have a whole archive of Ring videos in the cloud of all the people that have ever stopped by. And in a couple of cases, it's come in really handy. So there you go. Installing Ring takes minutes, and it works with either your current wiring or a built-in rechargeable battery. Just super cool technology. Put your mind at ease and protect your home with the video doorbell that Time Magazine and USA Today named one of their top 10 gadgets. Go to ring.com/TNT. You'll get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/TNT. With Ring, you're always home.
On Monday, Kim Kardashian tweeted that she was cashing an $80 million check from revenue she had earned from her Kimoji app. While she might not have earned quite that much, she and others with apps like hers do seem to be earning most of the money from the App Store these days. Joining us to talk about this is Renee Ritchie from iMore. Welcome, Renee.
Hi, Megan. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. So you wrote a great piece today called What No Indie Developer Wants to Hear About the App Store. Tell us what's going on in the App Store these days.
So, I mean, I think when the App Store first opened, everyone saw it as a huge opportunity because finally there was a one place on every iPhone back then, now iPad and other places, where people could discover and buy apps. And it simplified the process, you know, exponentially. Apple would host the apps. They would handle transactions for you. It got rid of a lot of the overhead and a lot of the burden from developers. And at the same time, Apple made the Objective-C Touch APIs, and it let they opened up programming to a far bigger audience than it was as well. And I think people thought there would be a gold rush, like anybody could make an application and become, if not a millionaire, then at least self-employed, self-sustainable, and they could sort of do what they always dreamed of doing. And while there were some initial successes, it was more like a lottery than it really was like an open opportunity for everyone. And as it's matured, I think it's become like a lot of other industries where you see Walmart compared to mom and pop shops and Amazon compared to bookstores and music stores, where it has opened up this entire mainstream community, but at the same time, it sort of commoditized apps and made them something that I'm calling them pop apps. I think Guy English came up with that term, where it's just they're almost ephemeral. You download a bunch of them. None of them have that much value or meaning for you, and you move on between them quickly. And that fundamentally changed what I think a lot of traditional developers thought would be their ongoing revenue stream.
Yeah, I mean, I see that a lot. I was just going through the Apple TV last night, just kind of scrolling through the apps there, and then there was just like one app maker for all of them. I can't even remember what their name, but it was like push the needle here, push the arrow there, do the circle that thing, and you know, it was just like exactly the same thing from the same person. Do you think this is just a natural evolution, or do you think it's a way that Apple runs the App Store that causes this?
So I tend to think it's evolutionary. I know there have been a lot of complaints about the App Store over the years, and they're absolutely justified. The way review is run is often capricious and opaque, and developers don't want to take a risk anymore because they've seen some developers slap down really hard. So that has a chilling effect. But at the same token, where the Android market is much more open, Google Play, there's far less of a review process. But the kind of apps we get aren't any better. The fastest way to get Apple to change would be to have an app on Google Play that is so good it's causing people to switch to Android. It's redefining the mobile experience. It's denting universes, but that hasn't happened. Apps like Instagram and Uber, which are probably the most defining apps of recent times, they work just fine on the iPhone, and they often come sooner, and some people would say, you know, they have a better initial experience. So there's very little pressure on Apple to change that. And at the same token, we don't have traditional levers like upgrade pricing and trials and a direct connection with customers. But again, that's fine when you have a few apps and a really like close-knit community like Mac developed, like the original Mac community for it. But now you have millions of apps and hundreds of millions of customers and hundreds of thousands of developers. And it's arguable whether all those people could be sustained by that traditional model.
Renee, what do you advise? Because I think one of the main complaints a lot of people have about the App Store, and same is true with podcasting as well, but more so the App Store, because Apple completely controls it. Where can people discover apps outside of the App Store?
Yeah, so I mean, discovery is a perpetual problem. Apple seemingly isn't aware of a lot of the advances in search, like nearest neighbor and, you know, fuzzy metrics. But
they bought that company Chomp a while ago, which designed to do that. And I think they just bought the competition, is what they were trying to do.
And the relevance of the searches, I mean, like, you type in a spelling mistake in Google and it tells you, did you mean this? And I type in Tweetbot and I don't get Tweetbot. And that to me is still remarkable 9 years into the App Store. So you can't even find something if you misspell it. But there are websites, you know, like we tried iMore to surface all the best stuff. There are dedicated websites to that. And also marketing. I mean, I think marketing is a part of any business. It's as important as design. It's as important as development. But traditionally, you didn't have to worry about it because there was very little competition. And if you made a high quality app, word spread almost instantaneously through the community. And now there's sort of this feeling that if I make a great app, that's enough. And unfortunately, that's part of it. But we're also in a world where there's venture capitalists and there's companies like Google and Amazon and Microsoft churning out really high quality apps, like arguably some of the best apps on the devices. And they're giving them away for free because it's not their primary business. It's what supports their primary business.
Not to mention, I mean, the smartphone like app ecosystem has grown so much since it was, you know, created not very long ago, by the way. So it was really easy to stand out early on if you created a really nice app because there weren't a whole lot of really nice apps. And now I'm coming from the Android side of things. I think it's kind of similar between Apple and Android as far as that's concerned, is that there's a lot of really nice, like you said, Renee, like really excellently designed apps by the companies and people with venture capital and the money behind it. So even if you're an independent developer and you make an incredible app, it's just really hard to stand out. There's millions of apps now. How do you do that?
It's impossible now because because the where you have discoverability. I mean, that's why I asked Renee the question. You know, trying to be discovered is impossible. And this, by the way, I should point out, it's not exclusive to apps. This is the problem with any kind of media, podcasting, YouTube channels, blogs in general. Dave Pell, who I love reading his Next Draft newsletter, he wrote a great piece on Medium saying that the internet is rigged now. Like, the way it was first introduced to us is, hey, you know, anybody can, you know, have a blog and be just as powerful as the New York Times. But now that sort of that feeling, that sentiment is almost impossible because, like what you said, Renee, you have to have marketing. It you just can't exist without it.
Mm-hmm. And it's really tough now, especially because we have such high expectations but such low value. So someone makes an app, we immediately want it for free on iPhone, on iPad, on Apple Watch, on Apple TV, on Android. And their developers expected to, even like Windows now, the one Windows app strategy, they want it to work on everywhere from mobile to desktop to laptop. And the developers expected to do all this for free. And none of this stuff is free. All of this is arduous. And they're being told at the same time they can't really make a living off of it if that is their primary business. Mm-hmm.
And what about the pricing? I mean, do you think $2.99 is the new 99 cents? I mean, do you think $2.99 is what most app developers are charging these days?
I think that back in the early days of the Mac, even recent days of the Mac, if you had a good $50, $100 app, people would only buy three or four of them a year. Maybe you'd have your Adobe, you know, you'd have your Office, you'd have a few things. But now, there's millions of apps and people are just loath to try it. If I'm expecting to download 60 apps this month, a ton of games and whatever new Notes app or whatever comes out, there's no way I'm going to pay a lot of money for those because there's just so many of them. And that destroys scarcity, which destroys value.
Yeah, and you mentioned trial versions. I mean, the iPad Pro is supposed to be a professional device with expensive apps, you know, apps that are $19.99, $29.99. But, I mean, are people really going to just invest that without having any chance to try it first?
No, not at all. So some apps are really clever, like UMake is a fantastic app. It lets you almost sculpt 3D models with your fingers. And it's free to download. There's, I think, $150 in-app purchase if you want the Pro version. But there's, again, relatively few apps that will be able to do that and do that well. There's always going to be niches. There's always going to be amazing apps that take them, like Pocket Casts, a great success story on Android. But the number of podcast apps that can do that is very, very low. Maybe there's only one or two in every category. And that's sustainable for a few developers, but not for all the developers who are now on those platforms.
Do you think, have you heard anything about them changing the offering trial versions in the App Store?
Well, the thing is, so one of the things that I wrote was that if Apple did all of that today, if they offered trials, if they did upgrade pricing, if they allowed direct relationships, I think that would buoy some apps for a short period of time and maybe a few apps for a longer period of time. But it's the same thing like Walmart and like Amazon. The economy is actually changing. The way people perceive apps is changing, and not, you might say not for the not for the better, because we're becoming increasingly greedy. We want everything for nothing as consumers. And Apple's not the only store. There's a Google Play Store, the Microsoft Store, and they have some of these. But, you know, Amazon was floating the idea of subscription apps, which would be like Netflix. You pay a monthly fee and download, you know, as many apps as you want, or like 30 apps or something for that. And all of this fundamentally changes the nature of that business. And I don't think there's any going back from that. It's going to be up to developers to sort of figure out what's next. And the other huge change is we've got things like extensibility now, where I never open pCalc anymore. I pull down Notification Center and I use the widget. So I never really see the app, and I never really open something like a Tumblr. I just use the share extension. So that in that an app pop up on my watch, they can pop up on my CarPlay dashboard. They're just features now that have been totally decoupled from apps. So what's the value of that? It's really unclear to me going forward.
Yeah, I mean, you know, on the other side of this, on the Android side of things, and Amazon specifically, they have Underground, which is a service that's essentially, I mean, it's free to users. You can download their app, and it brings paid apps, including, you know, in-app apps that would have in-app purchases. Mm-hmm. Those are all paid by Amazon so that you'll use that service. So essentially, what does that do? That kind of lowers the expectation on the user side of things, lowers the value of the app to a point to where it's like, well, even paid apps, like why am I paying for paid apps? I can get them over free at Underground.
Well, this is the one smart thing that like you brought up just a moment again, is $2.99, the price for apps. Once sort of everyone sort of accepts this is the value of this kind of a service, like the price of a ticket of a movie is this, the price of an album is this, the price of an app is this, then we all sort of come to an agreement. But when the market is sort of eager, like Amazon, and they start giving things away for free, or we go into the sort of the in-app purchase where you get it for free and then you scale up. It's kind of like going to a nightclub that, you know, they paper the room and they screw you on the drinks later. It's the same idea.
Yeah.
And I mean, people will pay for ego gratification and they'll pay for instant gratification. Those are the two things we will spend ungodly amounts of money on. But for everything else, it really is what you just said, the sum of all compromises. I don't want to pay for an app, so developers lower prices. So I learned that if I don't pay now, they'll do a sale or they'll drop the price. So I'll just wait for that. And that's a vicious cycle.
Yep. Really is.
Well, Renee, Saturday morning is when I like to listen to the iMore podcast. Who am I going to get to listen to tomorrow morning?
Georgia Dow and Michael Gartenberg. Trinity Caldwell was on vacation. So Michael Gartenberg, who was up until January the senior director of worldwide product marketing at Apple, joined us to talk about the upcoming Apple event and the ongoing FBI stuff.
So it's released on Friday, right? Has it
yes.
already been? So people don't have to wait. Just not everyone has the same Saturday morning ritual I do listening to the iMore
podcast.
Maybe
they should.
So you can get that at iMore.com. Thank you so much for joining us, Renee.
Thank you, Renee.
Thanks. Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Take care.
All right. TNT's fan of the day is Evan Harris at E-H-C-A-U, I don't know, on Twitter, who says he's, quote, watching yesterday's TNT on my flight to spend the weekend at Twit. Evan's visited many times before, by the way. So Twit welcomes you with open arms. We'll see you when you get here, Evan. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. You can record a video, take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post that on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it.
After the break, what's better than an exploding hoverboard? An exploding hoverboard that actually hovers. But first, let's take a minute to thank FreshBooks, the sponsor of this episode. If you are a freelancer or a small business and feeling stressed out by the stacks of receipts, spreadsheet formatting nightmares, and not enough time to deal with any of it, we have the solution for you. It's FreshBooks. Our friends at FreshBooks have created ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software that makes dealing with your taxes way less taxing. Getting started on FreshBooks could not be easier. And you want to get paid for your hard work? I'm assuming that you do. FreshBooks customers are paid an average of 5 days faster. Create and send invoices efficiently, plus get paid online quickly with FreshBooks payments. Have you heard this? On average, FreshBooks customers double their revenue in the first 24 months of using FreshBooks. You also have the option to request a deposit in FreshBooks and get paid up front. No more covering costs out of pockets or waiting until the end of a project to get paid. And they have made it incredibly easy for you to track your billable time. FreshBooks recently announced their tiny new EMV chip card-enabled card reader. It's very cute. It attaches to your mobile device, and now you can accept credit cards wherever business takes you, quickly and securely, with their easily redesigned iPhone app. plus create beautiful invoices in just seconds. FreshBooks estimates that by using FreshBooks, you might be able to free up 2 days per month to focus on the work that you love. With FreshBooks, you can focus on growing your business. You'll wonder why you didn't start with FreshBooks sooner. Getting started is simple, and it's totally free for 30 days. Go to FreshBooks.com/TNT, and don't forget to enter Tech News Today in the How Did You Hear About Us section. Start your 30-day free trial today, and we thank FreshBooks for supporting this episode of Tech News Today.
All right, we all know how much Megan loves the hoverboard.
I don't love the hoverboard.
How do you feel about a hoverboard that actually hovers?
That I might get behind.
All right.
Or on top of or something. I don't know.
The Hendo hoverboard was first shown off back in November 2014 when pro skating legend Tony Hawk jumped on and, well, let's face it, he kind of looked ridiculous at that point. It hovered, which is a feat in and of itself, but it was pretty slow. Not to mention it was super screechy, very noisy. Well, and oh, and here it is. Yeah, if you skip through, he just kind of like hops on. He does a couple of tricks, I suppose, but I don't know. I'm used to seeing
it moving
a lot faster.
Tony Hawk is having trouble on it.
Yes, exactly.
There's not much hope for the rest of us.
Exactly. Well, the Hendo hoverboard has been redesigned to version 2.0. Many improvements included in here. So what is this? It's magnetic field architecture. So basically what you saw underneath, and there's video on the current article to kind of show where it's at right now. It's a sheet of copper that's underneath. So you have to have copper, at least in this example, underneath in order to do it. A dynamic magnetic field in the engine that's on top of the copper actually creates an electric circuit. And then that creates the magnetic field that kind of repels and creates lift. So that's kind of how the technology works. The new version actually has a skateboard deck on top now. So mm-hmm. although it looks a little wider, I'm not really quite sure. But it also has skateboard trucks underneath that when you lean one way or another actually kind of tilts the
hover
engine.
Yeah, but according to the video, all they do is spin around in circles.
That's all you ever see them doing is spinning around in circles and falling off eventually. But, you know, it's kind of cool stuff.
Oh, it's way cool. I mean, how soon are we going to see this in the X Games? That's what I want to know.
Well, they'd have to have a treated track. But, I mean, they do that anyway. They have tracks for you to do. So,
of course, sure. How tough would it be to make a copper half pipes? You know?
as long as they're moving a little faster than they seem to always do in these demonstrations. But
yeah, I don't.
It doesn't look easy to ride at all.
But it's only $10,000, so you might as well just try it, right?
Only $10,000 for one of these? $10,000 for a board you can't control?
Well, that's what people paid on Kickstarter to get the first one. So I don't think they're actually going to try to sell each one for $10,000, but maybe.
They've made it more stable. They've cut down on noise. I think the B-roll that we were just watching was the old version. So if you skip forward just a little bit more, you'll see him riding this one. And
the real one.
I mean, it's a little bit of the same. For the most part, but you can see kind of you tilt your feet and it actually
and it doesn't
direction.
And it doesn't respond. That's what the video shows.
Because
you tilt your feet and it does not go. Oh no! What am I saying? The guy behind him was just spinning him. That's why he's spinning around.
But Jason, are you a skater?
No.
Okay.
No.
It's like you really like this.
I think it looks like fun. I would love to try this. I would love to be on something that's hovering over the ground. That like fulfills a nerd kind of fantasy that I've had ever since I watched Back to the Future 2.
Okay, got it. I see.
So, yes, I would love to do this at some point.
I think I overpromised that it was also going to explode.
There's no explosions going on here. A big part of what they're doing here, it's Arx Pax is the kind of creators behind this. They have developer hardware called the White Box so that you can tap into it at a smaller scale. The hover engines, the engines that are actually doing this work, $20,000. And there's, you know, they have a lot of plans. Like, this is just like one example of what you could do with this type of technology. The Hyperloop totally comes to mind as far as like a really good application of this technology potentially. And there are a lot of people designing, you know, what the pods will be like traveling through the Hyperloop. So who knows? Maybe this technology will be part of that.
It would be cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us. You tell us about your book. We have your book here.
Yes, my book. So if you go to a trade show, have you ever been to a trade show?
I haven't been to my fair share of trade shows.
So the name of the book is called 3 Feet from Seven Figures, One-on-One Engagement Techniques to Qualify More Leads at Trade Shows. And if you go to a trade show and you have to work the booth, however, this is a must-read book because you will qualify more leads trade shows. And I solely wrote it because I do so much work at trade shows and I see people staring at their phone, working at the computer, talking to their coworker, and not actually work in the trade show. This gives you tips on how do I stop a random person, qualify them, disqualify them, and move on.
Nice.
So 3feetbook.com, and the digital version is cheaper if you want to save money.
Excellent.
Okay. So people could download it if they're at South by Southwest right now.
Right now, yes. It's only $9.99.
They don't know what to do.
Digital,
they could download it.
$14.95 print.
We had a booth at the launch festival a couple of weeks ago. I was there to cover the launch festival. It was where we stored our equipment. That's about all.
Really?
Well, I mean, because we're out and about interviewing people, so it didn't make a whole lot of sense. But maybe we needed to read this and
anyway,
learn how
available,
to use it.
It's available at 3feetbook.com. The number 3 of the word 3, 3feetbook.com.
Excellent.
Well, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be back here.
Thanks for coming on.
We will have you back soon.
Yeah. Thank you.
Plop you right in the center here. David Spark, always a pleasure. 3feetbook.com. Monday's guest will be Matthew Ingram from Fortune. Welcoming back, Matthew. Always great when he's on. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can always take part in the show by emailing us. That's tnt@twit.tv. You can leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW. And you can find the show on Twitter. We are at TechNewsTodayTV.
We don't charge $29.99 or $2.99. We're free. Free podcast. Subscribe to it at twit.tv/TNT. And you can also get our newsletter at twit.tv/newsletter. And I am at Megan Maroney on Twitter.
I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Kara Cole, and all the folks who help us produce this show every single day. And thanks to you for talking tech with us. We will see y'all on Monday. Bye, everyone. Not sure how we do this.
High five.
High five.
High fives. There you go.